The Alaska Federation of Natives has expressed concern over a partial shutdown of the state's ferry system linking coastal communities. The state of Alaska is balking at paying a $4 million repair bill for a vessel that's the linchpin for service to Alaska's rural panhandle. That's having ripple effects across southeast Alaska. Huna is the largest Tlingit village in southeast Alaska. Mayor Jerry Beyer says local stores have been stockpiling dry goods, but fresh produce is getting harder to come by. There's been one sailing in November, and the community is bracing for a 20-day gap in December.
It's already expensive enough. If they have to fly that stuff over at 50 cents a pound, that's 8 pounds for a gallon of milk. So you're going to have to add that $4 on the cost they're already paying.
Four other communities are getting no ferries at all. All but one have no airports and are only served by seaplanes. The Alaska Federation of Natives passed a resolution this year calling for full funding to the state's ferry system following cuts to funding and schedules. A New Mexico tribe and federal officials plan to discuss the return of a sacred item. Acoma Pueblo leaders and officials with the U.S. Attorney's Office for New Mexico, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and Bureau of Indian Affairs are hosting a press conference Monday in Albuquerque. The tribe for years has been working with officials and politicians on the return of Native sacred items up for auction in Paris. U.S. lawmakers are seeking to prohibit the export of Native sacred items and increase penalties for the illegal trafficking of Native cultural items. The Bipartisan Safeguard Tribal Objects of Patrimony, or STOP Act, was reintroduced this summer in the Senate. The Missing and Murdered Dene Relatives Initiative is hosting a forum this week in Gallup, New Mexico. The working group is addressing the Navajo Nation's efforts to bring home missing family members and bring justice to Navajo families. Jolene Holgate is the coordinator for the group. She says they're working with various Navajo leaders, including the tribal council.
Through the leadership of Council Delegate Amber Crotty, she did get a group of us together, and we collaborate with the Navajo Nation Missing Persons Updates. As we were able to really take a look at what was happening on Navajo, we realized that MMDR was a very large issue, and there was no data being tracked, there was no cases being tracked, and because of that, we wanted to create a data institute, which would really give our nation a more clear picture of what is going on, the perpetrations, the hotspots, anything you name it, but as well as providing recommendations for change to leadership and to public safety to support them. The families came to us. The spirit of what we do is their voice and what it to meet their needs.
Advocate Meski Yatsati is the founder of Navajo Nation Missing Persons.
It happened in my family, and it continues to happen on the reservation, which a lot of people were not aware of. So I felt that it was something that I needed to bring to the attention of the public and the communities. My strongest message is that that all genders should be included. So when we talk about missing and murdered Indigenous women, we also need to include our LGBTQ and also our men and our boys.
This will be the third forum held by the group. Previous forums were held on the Navajo Reservation and in Flagstaff, Arizona. Various organizations and advocacy groups are expected to attend, including the New Mexico Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Task Force. The public is invited to give testimony. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by PrairieEdge.com, proud to provide traditional and contemporary American Indian craft supplies from feathers, furs, and hides to conchos, fringe, shells, and beads in Rapid City or online at PrairieEdge.com. Wopila. Support by the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism's MA in Journalism, stressing the foundation skills and knowledge that all good journalists must have. Application deadline is December 13th at journalism.cuny.edu.
Native Voice 1. The Native American Radio Network.
This is KZYX Philo 90.7 FM, KZYZ Willits and Ukiah 91.5 FM, and Fort Bragg at 88.1 FM. Welcome to the Farm and Garden Show. This is your host, Ruthie King. We have a great program coming up for you. We've got a live recording. What are we doing here, Rosebud? Where are we? We're in Willits. We're at the Carnegie Library in Willits. And yes, we have an amazing show. We've got some pre-recorded stories. We've got a guest on the air. And I'm joined here in the studio with Rosebud Ireland. As ranchers, we make a lifestyle and a livelihood out of grazing domesticated animals. So it's important that we all recognize that before this land was colonized by white people and domesticated ruminants, it was inhabited by native people and wild ruminants. Our existence here is a very recent occurrence in the grand scheme of things, and we have significantly thrown off the balance of predator-prey dynamics, as well as people-to-land relationships. The consequences of that imbalance are seen and felt by ranchers and environmentalists, and the conversation today will loop in ranchers on the ground and activists alike. So we're going to start today's program by hearing about a recent interaction between predator and prey, domesticated and wild. We'll be hearing from Paige Lynn Trotter, who grazes goats and sheep as a contract grazer in Northern California. She's centered mainly in Sonoma County. She grazes homeowners associations, public parks, transportation corridors, and all sorts of wild landscapes as well. So listen in as we hear from Paige about a recent encounter she had with a mountain lion this August. Oops, not that. Let's get this. Okay, here we go. And here's Paige Lynn.
The night of the encounter, it was just after darkness had fallen, and I had gone out to do my fence check a little bit later than I would typically like to do it, unfortunately. And that pretty much just consists of me turning the fence off, walking the fence line, making sure that there's no in areas where wildlife has maybe tried to crawl under, goats have cut their horns or pulled the fence up. And so I started to walk the fence line, making sure that everything was stable, and came across a goat body that had been recently killed. It was still warm, and I'm really not that great at evaluating cause of kill, so I couldn't figure it out in the dark what had happened. But immediately all my senses turned on, and I knew that there was something wrong, so I started to finish doing my check line, my fence line check, and went to go look for my goats in the paddock and figure out what was going on, and saw them all huddled in one corner of the paddock like there was something bothering them. Then as I continued to walk down the fence line, I came across another goat body, and I realized that this is like a predator issue. And the way that they were, the reason that that clicked with me is because the way that they were laying, they had been drugged to the fence line from the inside of the paddock. And so it clicked with me that something had killed them and tried to take them out and got zapped by my electric fence, and so went back in to get another one. And at that point, I went back to my truck and I got my headlamp and I came back out and looked at the bodies and found two very clear bite marks around the jaw of one of the goats. And so I realized that it was a broken neck, and I think I still hadn't actually put together that it was a cat kill. I just knew there was a predator, and so my next thought was, what's the priority here? And the priority is to get the dead bodies out of the paddock so that it doesn't draw in more predation in the night. And hadn't thought past that. That was just the next step. And so I pulled one of the goat bodies out of the paddock, and I went up and went to pull another goat body out, and it was a large goat body, so I kind of, it was rolling it up know, this is kind of a morbid description, I suppose, but I was rolling it up the hill to get it out of the paddock, and so I sat down on my butt and started pushing it with my legs, and the sound that came from inside of the paddock was this blood-curdling scream, like this very high-pitched, it was a mountain lion scream, and I immediately knew what the sound was, and so I stood up really slowly, and I looked around, and in the direction of the scream, there was just this mountain lion sitting there watching me, probably maybe 10 yards away from where I was standing, pushing its kill, trying to push its kill out underneath my electric fence. And in the moment, I lost all thought, what am I even doing? It was just, I need to get away from the situation I'm in. I didn't know where my dogs were. I didn't know where, I wasn't sure where my goats were at that point, so I began to just back down this hill, and I was totally unprepared for this encounter. I'm wearing, like, rolled-up jeans with flip-flops on, and I was lucky enough to have my headlamp in the moment, but just totally unprepared, and I'm backing down this hill through all of this poison oak, just trying to keep my eyes on this mountain lion, but I had to look down to catch my footing. And so when I looked down, she or he felt comfortable moving, and so when I looked back up, I was watching them walk down the hill to kind of get at eye level with me, and it was just this massive cat. I mean, it felt like his tail was as thicker than my neck, and it probably was. In the moment, it felt extremely large, and so I backed all the way down the hill, and I got out of the paddock and walked up the road just past the paddock and got into my truck and turned my truck on and blasted the horn and turned on my headlights and called a friend of mine and told him what was happening, because I just needed somebody to hear what my thought process was, and that I was thinking clearly, because I wanted to just open the fence and get my goats out, but I knew that wasn't a rational option in the dark. It's really difficult to move animals in the dark. It's really difficult to come up with a plan at 9 o'clock at night. And so I ended up opening up the paddock and pulling my truck into the paddock with my goats and going down and turning the fence back on and checking the paddock one more time and then getting into my truck and sitting with my goats kind of huddled all around the truck so that I could turn the headlights on and honk the horn if I needed to. I don't carry a gun. It never even crossed my mind that I would need a gun, but in that moment I felt like I need to figure out what is the best way to protect my animals tonight if this predator is going to come back and look for another opportunity to get dinner, and that was the best option. That was what I ended up coming up with. It felt like very poor planning on my part, and that was how we spent the entire night. It was a very strange experience. I don't remember feeling much like myself. You know, you kind of have this ideal version of yourself in your occupation of what would I do if I had this opportunity to come across a mountain lion, and I lost all sense of self in that moment, and all of my really kind of primal instincts kicked in, and I got really defensive of my animals and of my own life and of my dogs. And I remember sitting in the truck just watching the edge of the woods with my goats huddled around and thinking, I would totally kill this mountain lion. And I feel like I'm a no-kill, maybe not an advocate, but I feel like I practice no-kill grazing methods or my predation control is non-lethal, would be the right terminology. And so it was very odd to have this feeling of aggression towards this animal out of kind of a defensiveness that I was feeling. And I stayed up that way until, gosh, maybe 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning. I kept dozing off, but the goats were doing this thing that they do when they're defensive and nervous, where they rotate around each other and they kind of fight over who gets to sit in the middle of the herd. And so they're headbutting each other out to the outside of the herd and huddling up against the truck and trying to stay in the spot that feels the safest to them. And watching them in this state of panic is just making me more angry with this mountain lion for putting us in this position of fear. And I began to kind of doze off in and out, feeling this real sense of like anger and aggression towards this mountain lion as I'm doing so, and ended up falling asleep and having a really intense dream that I still haven't, to be honest, fully finished processing, but the dream led me into a completely different mindset. And in the dream, I was going through this same scenario over and over again, where I was going out and checking my goats, and the mountain lion kill would present itself, and I was really in a battle, a struggle with this mountain lion in this dream. It just kept replaying the scenario, and I finally made the decision in my dream that I was going to kill the mountain lion, and I went out, and in my dream, I chose a very bizarre method of trapping the mountain lion and slitting his throat as if I was going to bleed it out for a harvest or something. And when I did that, the mountain lion's eyes expanded, and it was almost like this motion picture started playing in the eyes of this, in my dream, she was a female mountain lion, and it played all these different scenes of what I would describe as a series of cultural oppressive, kind of the history of cultural oppression. And one of the specific scenes I remember was I remember it so well because it reminded me of a story that a Northern Cheyenne woman told me in Montana about her and a bunch of other mothers going and standing outside of this chain link gate outside of a boarding school where all of their kids have been taken when the area where their tribe had been living had been colonized, and they'd separated all of the children from the elders and put them into boarding schools so they could learn to be they could learn how to fit into white culture, learn how to speak English. And so the mothers had made this decision that we are going to go stand there and make sure our children can see this. We're not allowed to interact, but we won't let them think that we don't exist. We want to make sure that they remember us. And her story always really stuck with me, that, wow, that's something that's very recent. That's actually kind of still going on. And in my dream, it came up as a very clear image of that same woman who told me that story, standing outside of a chain link fence saying, we're still here. We won't let them forget we're still here. And I woke up with this realization that I did not want to participate in separating anybody from their culture, even if it wasn't my own species, even if it was, you know, something that was threatening my own life, that I didn't want to participate in cultural oppression or destruction in that way. And when I woke up from that dream with that realization, and I had tears streaming down my face because there was a lot of different images in that kind of motion picture that the lion's eyes had shown me. My goats were huddled all around my truck were all laying down for the first time. They were all laying down. They were all chewing their cud, and they were all quiet. Nobody was headbutting each other. Nobody was nervous. And the forest edge felt like so much more peaceful than when I'd fallen asleep and had this dream that had helped me process that anger and that fear. And I woke up and realized, no, we're not going to leave, and we're not going to kill this mountain lion. We're going to try. We're going to try to learn what the lesson here is and how can we better live with lions. And so I texted a trapper friend of mine at 3 o'clock in the morning, and she texted me back maybe at 5 or 6 in the morning and said, you need to contact this company, I think it's a nonprofit organization called Living with Lions. And so I contacted them first thing in the morning and let them know I had this encounter. I lost some of my goats, and the lion presented themselves to me and let me stand in the paddock with them. And I backed away. And this is after describing it to them, they felt like they were really overbooked and didn't have the capacity to come out there. But because of the fact that the lion was willing to interact with me and I had multiple kills in one paddock, it was a unique situation. And they came out and set a trap in hopes to catch the lion and either collar it or identify if it was a collared lion, who it was, and if this was a lion that had been repeatedly causing problems or maybe a young lion. And they walked me through this really interesting process of what are their goals and what are they trying to achieve. And they gave me a couple of management changes that they asked me to make, and I agreed to, which included bringing my goats in at night. We converted an old wine cave to kind of a closed-in shed, so it had a wall. It was a wine cave with no door, so we ended up adding a door to it, basically, so that every night the goats could go into that safe space. I also ended up with a friend. I ended up having a friend loan me a guard dog to put in with them when they were out during the day, and he went in and slept with them in the wine cave at night. So we just made all these kind of extreme changes. If you don't know the contract grazing context, it's a fully mobile operation that, you know, you don't take infrastructure like sheds and barns and things that would fit into a conventional setting in a little easier, and also make it a little easier to protect your animals. We don't use any of those things. We use electric netting, and that stands up to everything but lions, as far as my experience goes. And so we made all of these changes and really tried to learn to live with lions. I really thought that we were putting in our best effort. We increased the number of times we were moving our animals so they weren't in the same spot for too long. And I ended up, I already had a living trailer there, but because I have other jobs, I was having to come and go. So I ended up bringing on a second shepherd so that any time that I wasn't there, there was another shepherd there. So there was human presence. And that was really what living with lions was, number one, biggest deterrent for lions is just human interaction. They don't want to be, they said, even if you just wander away to the other side of the property, turn on talk radio or something that would deter lions from coming around because they think there's a human presence. And so I did all of those things. I mean, I checked every box off the list of what I could do better in order to learn to live with lions and pushed through the next 2 weeks of finishing out this grazing project and trying to target the forest edge and push back the brush and,
So we'll hear the rest of Paige's story at the end of this program here, and we're going to go back to listening to this beautiful song that we started hearing at the beginning of the show before we go into our next interview. That was Coyote Lullaby, and I'm here joined in the studio by the songwriter of that song, Rosebud Ireland. Thank you for being here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Ruthie.
Can you tell us a little bit about that song, Coyote Lullaby, we've just been hearing?
Yes. Coyote Lullaby is a song that my husband, Scott, and I recorded, interestingly, on our first new CD that was after 2 years of Scott recovering from a broken neck that had left him temporarily paralyzed. He was told by the physician that he would likely never play again. So this first new recording after that recovery period of 2 years plus was a great celebration. And when he was finally able to walk again, we went camping a number of times to get him out to the healing powers of nature, and we would hear coyotes gently singing us to sleep most nights. I know some call them God's little song dogs, and they truly helped us both to heal. In total now, we've recorded 8 CDs together and 2 solo each, and he's just becoming a more incredible guitarist day by day, actually. He's very inspiring.
And your vocals on that song are just incredible. So thanks for sharing that with us. And Rosebud, you're also a member of the Mendocino Non-Lethal Wildlife Alliance. And that's what brings us here today, is an event that you're putting on. So can you give us a snapshot of that event coming up?
Yeah, for sure. I was going to say I'm a longtime musician, guitarist, vocalist, songwriter, with a degree in biology, emphasis in wildlife biology. So just my background, why I'm in the Mendo Non-Lethal Wildlife Alliance. We're an organization helping to raise awareness on conflicts on issues of conflicts between wild animals, livestock, and people. And to that end, we're having our second Mendocino event. The first was a coastal event at Casper Community Center, and this event is a community forum on ranching with wildlife. It's sponsored by the Redwood Valley Grange, Mendocino Non-Lethal Wildlife Alliance, and Project Coyote. It will take place this Wednesday, November 20th, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Redwood Valley Grange. The event is free and open to the public. Speakers will be followed by a Q&A session, so participatory. We're hoping for that. And
yeah, and we actually are fortunate enough to be joined today on air by one of the speakers who will be there on Wednesday. So if this show sparks any interest in you, and or you'd like to learn more about what Mendocino Non-Lethal Wildlife Alliance is doing, or you're a rancher with experience, you know, living and ranching with wildlife, we'd love for you to be there, and we'd love for you to be there to hear from Kelly Hendricks. And Kelly Hendricks is on the air with us today. She and her husband manage Bar CR Ranch in Petaluma. It's a cow-calf operation. Kelly's got a background in horse training, and she works with Sonoma County Wildlife Rescue. She's also on the board of Project Coyote. So let's bring her up. Welcome to the program, Kelly. Are you there?
Yes, hi. Thanks for having me.
Hi. Yeah, thank you so much. And we're all looking forward to hearing more about the work that you do with Project Coyote. So can you first tell us a little bit about the mission of Project Coyote?
Yeah, our mission, we're a nationwide organization, and our mission is to help people coexist with native carnivores using education, science, and advocacy.
Great, yes. And that's something that you practice on your ranch in Petaluma, I imagine?
Yeah, I started working with Project Coyote I think in 2012, because I've worked on ranches my whole life, and I've just seen so many needless conflicts take place, and I always knew that when I had more time, I wanted to focus on issues with human and wildlife interactions and conflicts. And so when I retired from horse training, I found them online, and I was really impressed with their work and their science advisory board, which has like a dozen of the top wild canid scientists in the world, and I reached out to them, and I've been working with them since.
That's wonderful. So, you know, we did hear at the beginning of this program a story of an interaction with a mountain lion, not a coyote, but I think that ranchers are working on landscapes that have all sorts of predators and apex predators and carnivores living amongst us. Paige talked a little bit about some of the management changes that she made, including penning her animals at night, and she already uses electric fence and having human presence. And so I wonder if you have any reflections on those things that individuals can do, but also what are the changes that can be made at a broader level to encourage coexistence?
Yeah, I was listening to her story, Paige's story, and it was just fascinating to listen to, and I was so impressed with her knee-jerk reaction upon seeing her animals killed is like most people's would be. It's just your initial reaction, you are angry and you have that sense of wanting some revenge. And then she spoke about her dream and everything that came to her and her, for whatever reason that people find the reasoning to come to the conclusion that maybe that's not your knee-jerk reaction is not always the best way when it comes to resolving conflicts. And so that it really impressed me, because sometimes as ranchers we can be skit set in our ways, and sometimes the danger when you become an expert in your field is you're not open to trying new ideas or thinking of new things. So her willingness to adopt these new changes and try them I find really impressive.
I absolutely agree, yeah.
And on a broader level, those things we can do to live with predators, I think some of the changes that need to be made is for our state wildlife agencies that look at predators as kind of vermin, and they're run mostly by hunting and ranching interests and consumptive activities. And the majority of the, you know, wildlife's in a public trust for all Americans, and the majority of people aren't hunters and ranchers, and they should have a say in how these animals are managed, but right now they really don't. So, and the sad thing is that a lot of times in the hunting and ranching industries, they don't appreciate the value of predators as and the values they bring to ecosystems, and they're looked at as vermin that can be killed mostly in most states year-round with no bag limits. So I think those things need to be changed, and also people in urban areas, I think. You know, a lot of times the onus is on ranchers, and the ranching industry's kind of got a bad rap for using too much lethal controls, but in urban areas we see the same problem. The people have a raccoon under the house and they don't want it there, so they have a trapper come and remove it, it's killed, instead of taking the responsibility to do the exclusion work on their homes to prevent these conflicts from taking place in the first, you know, in the first place.
And you mentioned in that answer that a lot of people don't understand what the value is of predators on the landscape. And so, you know, I think Rosebud and I were talking about this a little before the show, that there's all sorts of reasons to look at and reconsider the way that we interact with predators. And sometimes, you know, people are drawn to different sorts of reasoning. And so sometimes it's an ethics-based reasoning, sometimes it's a science-based reasoning, often it's a combination of all of the things. But can you talk to us about the value, you know, either scientific or just sort of the intrinsic value that predators or native carnivores add to the ranchlands?
Sure. Well, on a practical level for ranchers, just the values that they add in the sense that they control herbivore populations. And a study was done in Utah a few years ago where cattle were grazing alongside wild bison. And the ranchers were upset thinking that the bison were out competing the cattle. So they did this 2-year study and they determined that cattle were eating the vast majority of the forage, and that the second most forage was consumed by rabbits, jackrabbits. So a third of the forage was consumed by jackrabbits, and bison were only eating 13% of the forage. So, and the reason this had happened was because of the widespread predator control they had done. So they'd wiped out all the coyotes, and of course this allowed the jackrabbit populations to bloom, and it just shows, it's an example of what can happen, unintended consequences that happen when we remove predators. And another good example, which bizarrely hardly any people have heard of, is the great rodent invasion, and it was the biggest one in U.S. history, and it took place in the late 1920s in Kern County. And what happened was they had done massive predator control throughout the county, so it ended up happening was a huge rodent bloom. I think the count at the height of it was like 100 million mice in the area, and the residents were reporting that the mice were running over their bodies all night in bed, and they said when they drove on the roads, your tires would squish because there were just so many rodents they were running over.
Oh, my goodness.
They were eating livestock in their pens. I mean, there was just a massive amount of mice. So thankfully what happened was ravens started coming back, and owls and hawks, and all the rafters came back, and they finally got the balance back under check. But it can show you the types of things that can happen when we just remove a large amount of predators, thinking we're protecting, you know, livestock.
Yeah, absolutely. I had the experience moving to the ranch where I raise sheep now, of moving to a place that had a very strong coyote population and a couple of dens sort of surrounding the grazing areas. And it's a cattle ranch, so coyotes aren't generally, you know, a problem for predators for cattle. But with sheep, it's a different story. And you know, I remember falling asleep at night and hearing coyotes calling from all the corners of the property. And I used electric fencing, and I used, you know, and now I have these amazing donkey guardian animals. But I remember doing, maybe it was at the Hopland Research Center. There was some studies that were shown, and even just experience shown, that it's not only us learning to live with wildlife, but sort of co-learning with the coyotes, that these are the boundaries. This is your territory, and I'm carving out this space for myself. And that I've heard that eliminating a coyote population doesn't eliminate the coyote population. It just opens up a power vacuum where other coyotes who have not been trained about you know, what are the boundaries of this ranch, and what's, and, you know, what are the areas that I'm asking you to stay out of? And it seems like the coyote population on the ranch where I've been living has developed this respect for zones, and that there's a zone that I've carved out, you know, that I've carved out over the years, that's my zone, and there's these coyotes that have passed down that knowledge and that information every year to their pups, I imagine.
Right.
So can you talk about what happens after a predator is removed from a ranch, for instance?
Well, this is the thing we're starting to understand, is that these predators have really complex social lives, and even predators that we consider solitary animals, like mountain lions, when you remove one mountain lion from an area, it can affect the populations over a widespread area, you know. And what can happen is we'll remove an animal, even if it's for a public safety reason or something, and oftentimes that puts the livestock, pets, and people into more danger because of the upheaval that happens within these predator populations. It leaves younger animals on the landscape without that knowledge, like you said, that cultural knowledge that's passed down from generations, and they don't know how to behave around people. It orphans young before they've developed an ability to hunt on their own, which makes them seek out more vulnerable prey. And like you said, leaving a stable coyote population in place can be the best thing you can do, and you can benefit from the rodent control that they provide, while they've learned how to, they've passed on to their young how to respect the boundaries of and to how just to prey on their normal prey, you know. So they'll leave the livestock alone, and it's an ideal situation where if you'd gone in there and just started wiping out the coyotes, you'd be left with that young, uneducated population that would be more prone to preying on your livestock, which is how we've gotten to ourselves into this mess where we just keep killing coyotes and not realizing that we're causing this upheaval. These animals that are in these situations, it turns out to be a lot like humans in war zone. You know, it messes with their psyche, and it just makes them more desperate and less available to avoid conflicts with us.
Hmm. Yeah, that's so well said, Kelly. Now that we have this best science coming forward, we're seeing that other animal species populations are not that disparate, not that much, you know, different from humans when you disrupt a family structure, you know, in any way like this. And whether it's the alpha pair who have been kind of keeping the younger animals in check, mountain lions, coyotes, wolves, the disruption occurs on many levels, and indiscriminate killing of predators, so-called, you know, native carnivores, are really having massive effects now that it's happening, you know, on such a grand scale in the United States. And now we're having to deal with realizing that these traditional methods of managing human versus wildlife conflicts by killing them with traps, snares, poisons, aerial gunning, you know, it's not working, it's backfiring, and it's being challenged across much of the West, not only in California, but also in the Pacific Northwest, the Rockies, and beyond. So, you know, we in Mendocino are certainly not alone in this endeavor. You know, we're coming to...
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing that we now have the advantage of all this information. As you know, Dr. Bob Crabtree from Yellowstone Research Center spoke at our Mendo Coastal event, has been studying predator-prey relations for over 20 years. It might be going into 30 years, and was explaining all this to us, you know, especially the aspect that what do you get when you indiscriminately, when you kill coyotes, you get more coyotes, right? And it's not right. Just that the litter size increases, it also has to do with the survival rate of those coyote pups. So it's built into nature to, you know, not only to survive, but to thrive. And this is wonderful that we've got this information now, the best science that's showing that to us. So thank you.
Yeah,
for
it's easy to it's easy to think, you know, people think that, oh gosh, I'm seeing more coyotes than ever before. They must be overpopulating, you know. It really helps to have that science-based background to draw upon to realize that, no, there's reasons you're seeing more. It has nothing to do with the number of coyotes that are there, that there's a lot of disruption within their social structures that sometimes can cause these type of things. And it's just fascinating, especially working with them hands-on in the wildlife rescue. You really see how similar they are to humans and our pets, you know, and their emotional lives, you know, and how they can suffer from things like PTSD and the same things that we suffer from. So keeping their societies in the war zones doesn't help anybody.
That's a great analogy, actually. And I think we're seeing that a lot of us are coming to understand this now that the information is becoming more available, and the public wants not only food and open space provided by farms and ranches, right, but also to enjoy sustainable populations of wildlife as part of the rural and suburban environment, you know, where we can unveil and celebrate the rich tapestry of lovely sentient wild things whose vast wonder we're just beginning to understand. And
right, it's really enriching for our lives to have them around, not just from what they can provide for us, but just to, you know, spiritually, it's really important to have them on the landscape.
Yeah, Paige's story was so, I know it's not finished yet, I can't wait to hear the rest of it.
I
was so inspired by her openness in the face of fear, you know, the initial fear, the amygdala lockdown where, you know, you're not even, you're in an altered state of sorts, and how she handled that, you know, I think it shows, and we'll hear further from her, that this isn't an either-or situation. We can have both,
right,
and we can have coexistence and return to a more natural balance with all wildlife, you know, kind of the original indigenous, as Paige Lynn alluded to, with her amazingly and you know, inspiring story of then going and communicating with living with lions.
And you know, I do want to mention Paige Lynn had contact living with lions. She had done this work, and we will hear and maybe I'll play it right now, but I'll just introduce it by saying that, you know, and unfortunately, there isn't a silver bullet, easy solution for conflict that ranchers have with wildlife. And there are a lot of options. There are a lot of things that we can do to mitigate and have peaceful relationships. And that it's not necessarily always the case. And sometimes individuals act differently from the general population. And sometimes these methods that we use don't work. And I think that it's important to show that that we can try these things, but really it's going to be a long process of reformatting the relationships and reformatting the dynamics. And and so I think I will play now just a couple of minutes the ending of this story from Paige before we hear some of her reflections of it. And then we'll bring you back on, Kelly, and we can talk about that. So let's...
Great, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Two weeks later, with a different shepherd who was living in my living trailer that morning, we had put the animals out into their paddock, and I was on my way out of town for a half day, and she called me about 2 hours later and said that, oh, there had been another lion attack at 9 o'clock in the morning with the guard dog in the paddock after they had come out of the wine cave. And so this kind of sense of defeat fell on me for a moment of I've tried everything. I really thought this was it. I was going to learn how to live with lions. And, but there was also a much different initial reaction. I wasn't fearful or defensive or angry. I was just more than willing to just hand over that piece of land to that lion and go get my goats. And we did exactly that. I had a hauler come and show up a couple hours later, and we loaded up the goats and we went to a different space that we know of, and really felt like this is the right move given that I've given this my best shot, and realized later on, after thinking about that entire experience, that I was really acting in haste, that I thought that I could just fix this using all of, you know, apply all of those management practices and correct my mistake of going into this setting, this really lion habitat, in a naive way, and instead of realizing that this is an entire culture that I have to learn to integrate myself into, and as much as I need to learn to live with lions, lions also have to learn to live with us. So this is a long-term relationship that's going to take years or decades to develop. And so getting the opportunity to load up my animals and leave really gave me the chance to say, you know, I'm committed to this for the long term. I can do this for the short term because I want to be committed to this for the long term. And I don't know what that looks like. I don't know if those management practices are going to be the ones that stick. But I guess we're just going to find out as we keep pushing through, right?
So that's 2 weeks later after the initial lion kill, and we don't know if it's the same lion. But it was, I think that she said that they had identified it was a young male that had been back the second time, and a 9 a.m. Entrance into a paddock with a guard dog is a pretty bold move. But I really appreciate Paige's perspective that it is a long process, and that it's not only us learning to change our management, it's also, in some ways, it's training these carnivores, these apex carnivore predators that haven't evolved with fence lines and domesticated animals, and you know, it's a very recent thing in history to have humans with fences and domesticated animals on the landscape. So Kelly, I just want to hear from you a little bit about what you hope to accomplish at the upcoming community forum, the Ranching with Wildlife Forum at Redwood Valley Grange this Wednesday night.
Well, I hope that we can open some minds to the value that predators have and why they benefit us all to have them on the landscape. And I hope people will leave with some ideas about some new tools they can try, and the importance of having the open mind about trying them, because in that sense we can learn a lot about coyotes, because they're super successful. One of the reasons they're so successful is because they're so adaptive behaviorally. And like Paige was talking about in this last part of her story that she was talking about, when she said at first, you know, she was ready to give up, but then she realized, you know, that she just moved her animals, she realized it's a long-term thing. She's willing to adjust her behavior, and that's the secret to being successful. And as humans, sometimes we can be really rigid and we can be really resistant to change. And I think to be successful as an industry, you know, with the ranching, like most successful business, we have to be willing to adapt and change and see the changes on the horizon, that society is feeling different about these animals. And it's time for us to adjust our practices so that we're more in line with the current sentiment.
And the current science, it's interesting. It is both. It's both the current sentiment and the current science. And I think I absolutely agree that there's a lot we can learn from coyotes in terms of our adaptivity. And I really appreciated Paige's mindset on that, that, you know, it's not that she tried and she failed and, oh, well, go back to the old ways. It's that this is going to be a long process. You know, she did mention that she's never had had any predation from coyotes because she uses electric fence, and that's what I use with my sheep too. It's a great training tool if what you're working on is a long-term training of a native population, that it's not a good idea to go after the animals inside of the fence that zaps your nose when you smell it. So electric netting is a tool that I've seen more and more people use, and it works really well with coyotes. And so I just encourage people to look into, like you said, other ways that we can change the way that we are managing our animals, rather than asking the native animals to change radically who they are.
Right. It's very contextual, too. You know, every operation is going to be different. Every situation is going to be different, depending on the kind of livestock you got, the vegetation, the terrain. So what works for one operation is not necessarily going to work for another. So, you know, we need to look at our operation and figure out what tools will work best for us.
That is a great thing. Yes, it's all site specific for sure. I just wanted to also, you know, commend Paige Lynn that as the planet becomes more and more crowded with people, it's also a moral issue is emerging that she's alluding to within herself beyond even the scope of potential ill effects resulting from disrupting entire wild ecosystems through this indiscriminate killing of apex predators / native carnivores such as the mountain lion, who in Mendocino County, mountain lion decreasing numbers in our county are now coming under deeper scrutiny. So this, you know, added ethical issue around how much wildlife may legitimately be killed or displaced is rising, and I'm really grateful she's addressing that.
And I'm also wanting to hear this last reflection from Paige Lynn, so I just want to say, for those of you listeners that were intrigued by this conversation, you can hear more from Kelly Hendricks this Wednesday night at the Redwood Valley Grange from 6 to 8 p.m. That's a community forum on ranching with wildlife. You can learn more about Kelly Hendricks' work with Project Coyote at their website, which is projectcoyote.org. And thank you so much for joining us today, Kelly. It was a great conversation.
Thank you. It's great talking with you guys.
So next we're going to bring up some of the final reflections that Paige Lynn had about her mountain lion encounter.
Oh, that it is so easy when you're in a place of fear or you feel overpowered or you feel oppressed. You know, I did have that instant of like, this mountain lion has completely overpowered me in my operation. I'm totally stuck in this place of not having any power in this relationship. And all I want to do is just kill that thing and rid it of my life so that I can not feel fear. And I didn't wake up with an answer. I just woke up knowing I don't want to do it that way. I know that way would work for a minute, but I know it doesn't work for the long term because people end up feeling, because somebody always ends up oppressed. And I truly believe that, like, moving forward in the world with the goal for everybody to have the opportunity to thrive is going to lead us into a healthier community space.
I think that's such an important point that she makes, and really drawing the connection between the cultural oppression that we talk about and that we're aware of and that we're really looking at in our society from human to human, but applying that also to the wildlife and to the plants and the animals that are around us is such a great, interesting perspective. And we're going to hear one final clip from Paige before we finish out this show.
I've come to feel very appreciative for the apex predators on the landscapes that I manage, because they provide something to me that I struggle to find in a lot of my relationships, and that's accountability. They really set a stage for, they keep me accountable to what it is that I'm called to do. And I can't be lazy about it, and I can't take the easy way out, and I can't just destroy what makes me uncomfortable. I have to lean into the discomfort. I have to learn. I have to get better, and I have to be held accountable to make sure that if I want to be in relationship with this domestic species that, you know, needs somebody to protect them in order for them to be able to produce meat for me or graze the land the way that I think the land should be grazed. I mean, that's a whole nother conversation, but that I really feel the apex predators, especially the mountain lion, really keeps me accountable to that. The coyote keeps me accountable in a lot of ways, but I think with the electric fencing, I've never had to deal with a coyote attack the way that I had to deal with the mountain lion attack. That it was a real humbling experience, and I realized that I fell short that night in allowing for my goats to become, you know, the epitome of being a prey animal attacked. And it also really changed my relationship with death and my realization that we really lack a death culture where I could experience that and not allow for this overflow of maybe I would consider it unhealthy responses or unhealthy emotions that I had in reaction to. I didn't know how to process the death of the unwanted death of an animal, and that's coming from somebody who's participated in slaughter for the last couple of years, and so that really struck me. Like, my relationship with death is so on my terms that it really limits me in those moments when I need to react in a holistic way and step back and look at the big picture.
Wow. Yeah, it's not often that we hear from someone who has such deep reverence to good relationship building, and you know I've experienced that with Paigelyn as a person, and to hear about her relationships that she has with her animals and the land that she works on, you know, it makes me think of the ancient contract that we talk about when we first domesticated animals, that we would provide. You know, it was this exchange that we provide food and we provide shelter and safety and a swift death, and in exchange, you know, we get the products, the fiber and the meat and the eggs and the milk, and but that it is this contract, it's this exchange, and that relationship I think has largely been sort of washed away. And I also want to just say that I didn't have time to put this piece of our interview in, but Paige and I often talk about the feminine in ranching and how there's this different way that is different from a dominant, aggressive kind of framework. You know, that conventionally we have this real dominance over the land and the systems that we produce food from, and a kind of a more gentle and holistic approach that is complex and works with like a wide variety of different pieces of the puzzle is this newly emerging kind of ranching in relationship, we've been calling it. And Paigelyn talks about how the most important piece of it is that the first step is listening, and that you do a lot more listening and a lot more seeking to understand, and less control over all the systems. So that concludes our Paigelyn Trotter interviews, and I just am so glad that we got to share that with our listening public today, and I'm so grateful that you were here to help put this all together, Rosebud. And we have a few minutes left, and I want to open it up if you have anything you'd like to add to the end of this show.
Thank you so much, Ruthie. I'm truly inspired by Paigelyn's honesty in speaking to living in open-hearted relation to wildlife, the original indigenous, and Ruthie, your mention of our ancient contract with our wild brothers and sisters, contracts, you know, in Mendocino County, the first U.S. county to elevate beyond the issues surrounding GMO, Mendo Public has a wonderful opportunity now to move beyond the old path that no longer serves us all onto a vibrant, non-lethal, prioritized new path that heals and joins us all, and to set an example for science-based wildlife management while shifting that paradigm to coexistence, using modern practices that allow every wild species to find food and shelter and the opportunity to maintain stable populations. And when we put wildlife management under local controls in terms of overall policies, rulemaking, decision-making regarding conflicts between wild animals, livestock, and people, as we're discussing, we have the rare opportunity to forge a more humble, reverent, and altruistic relationship with the natural world. And that sounds like the Mendo I know and love. So may I give the details again one
yes,
more time, please?
Yep.
Thank you. So everyone is invited to this free event. It's a community forum on ranching with wildlife sponsored by Redwood Valley Grange. It is this Wednesday, November 20th, 6 to 8 p.m., Redwood Valley Grange. And I would just like to say, you know, we all have room for further education. We've got three amazing speakers coming to share information related to ranching with wildlife, including latest research and the most effective non-lethal techniques for protecting livestock while conserving habitat, wildlife, and natural resources. And I truly feel that all of us coming together, especially within the gracious arms of Redwood Valley Grange community who survived the devastating fires, are, you know, inviting us from whatever walk of life